Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University. Tonight's lecture is titled, Where is Britain? The UK, the EU, and the United States. Speaking will be Sir Stephen Wall, permanent representative to the European Union and former EU advisor to Tony Blair. Responding will be Stanley Hoffman, Paul and Catherine Buttenweiser University professor at Harvard University. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Today's lecture by Sir Stephen Wall is entitled Where is Britain, the UK, the EU, and the United States? Responding to Sir Stephen is Professor Stanley Hoffman. So let me introduce the speakers very briefly. Sir Stephen Wall is principal advisor to Cardinal Murphy O'Connor, Roman Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, and a member of the he's a member of the Board of Britain in Europe. He was until last year EU advisor to Tony Blair and United Kingdom permanent representative in the European Union. He joined the diplomatic service in 1968 and headed the Foreign Office EU department for 5 years from 1983 till 1988. He was private secretary to Prime Minister John Major from 1991 to 1993 and ambassador to Portugal for 2 years afterwards. An article of his entitled A No to Europe Would Endanger Britain appeared in the Financial Times on January 20th. Professor Stanley Hoffman is Paul and Catherine Buttenweiser University Professor at Harvard University, where he has taught since 1955. He was the chairman of Harvard Center and founder also of Harvard Center for European Studies from its creation in 1969 till 1995. He has published many books and articles, including most recently America Goes Backward, and Gulliver Unbound, The Imperial Temptation and the War in Iraq. He's also an essayist for the New York Review of Books and Western European Reviewer for Foreign Affairs. I will not take a lot of our time. I just want to say that this is a very important moment for us here and for Europe, that Europe is on the brink of several referenda in which European Constitution is going to be voted, and there is a real change in the relationship between European Union and the United States. So we are very, very fortunate to have two such wonderful speakers here to enlighten us about these issues. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for coming this evening. When I was British ambassador to the European Union, my wife conducted a private and quite successful campaign against British advertisers such as travel agents who advertised bargain trips to Europe or travel to Europe. We laugh at the old headline, fog in channel, continent cut off, but we in Britain note how badly the European economy is doing compared with our own British economy, as if they were entirely separate things. We do indeed go to Europe for our vacations, and as Timothy Garton-Ash has pointed out, we refer to the Atlantic as the pond, thereby making the point that psychologically it is, or was, because I believe it's getting wider, smaller than the channel which separates us from the continental mainland. And there are umpteen explanations for how this feeling that Britain is not part of Europe came about and why it persists. Some of them are relevant to our continuing preoccupation with our relationship with the United States, and some are not. And part of my argument this evening will be that Britain has in fact taken a decision as to where its place in the world is. In other words, we have found a role, we are just not sure that we like it very much. Geography and the history that goes with that geography is undoubtedly the main explanation for the British sense that Europe is somewhere else. And I do not propose to delve too deeply into the historical context, but a few illustrations may be worth giving. A Venetian merchant visiting London in the early 16th century found London dirty, scruffy, and poorly fed. yet he also found Londoners convinced that their city was the grandest, their clothes the finest, and their food the most tasty anywhere to be found. So the smug self-satisfaction of the island dweller who does not know about abroad is one explanation. Yet even so, even then, the situation was not as simplistically isolationist as that description might imply. This was, after all, the London into which the great politician and martyr Thomas More was born. It was pre-Reformation London, and despite the findings of our Venetian merchant, was marked by a Europe-wide discourse among the educated elite. Thomas More and John Fisher, who were to lose their heads literally within days of each other, conducted an intimately learned and extensive correspondence with Erasmus in the Low Countries. The history of Britain and her continental neighbours was inextricably mixed up when More was born, a time when Britain had possessed a chunk of France was still within living memory. And the Reformation is, I believe, the turning point. Certainly the Reformation and its aftermath are as much in English history about the resistance to continental encroachment as about religious difference. I will give you two examples of what I mean. In 1931, so within living memory, my father, who was a Wesleyan or Methodist, got engaged to my mother, a Roman Catholic. And the Roman Catholic Church required a written undertaking from my father that the children of the marriage would be brought up as Catholics. And my father and his family came from a long line of farmers in Derbyshire, hilly, snowy country in the centre of England, where they reared pigs and sheep and sold them in the local market. And my father's aunt, who was an Anglican, wrote to my father when he got engaged to my mother in the following terms, and I quote, "May I, out of my love and interest in you, say something? There is in the old church in Darleydale a record dating back over 300 years, I believe, of a family of Walls, strong churchmen, yeomen, the very backbone and breath of England. Do not let your children break this record. I think it is a grand record and something to be proud of and to hand down to posterity. Think again before you sign their liberty away." Now, I do not imagine that my great aunt had the slightest notion about the doctrines of the Catholic Church. What she did have was a strong notion that the Roman Catholic Church was the enemy of English liberty. Fundamentally, her objection was that English children brought up as Catholics would be sold out to an alien authority. The Reformation was the symbol of English liberty and independence. When I left government service just under a year ago, and went to work for the Catholic Church in England, I was interviewed by the BBC about the European Union on one of the most sedate and serious of the BBC's news programmes. At the end of his questions about the European Union, the interviewer turned to my new job and asked, "What is it like to be working for a foreign power?" The foreign power in question, the Catholic Church. And I'm sure that that question, in that form, would have been asked in no other country in Europe, and the interviewer thought it a perfectly normal question to ask. Harold Macmillan, who as British Prime Minister launched the first British bid to join the European community in the 1960s, played a part in the early discussions in Europe of the coal and steel community and the abortive European defence community. Even he, as a pro-European, wrote in his diary of what he called the federal versus the functional approach, united Europe with Britain on a loose basis of cooperation or united Europe without Britain. Macmillan records Ernest Bevin, the British Foreign Secretary who was one of the creators of NATO, in a debate on Europe in the House of Commons in 1950. And I quote, "The Foreign Secretary," writes Macmillan, "wound up with the worst oration I have ever heard, even from him. The chief purpose of his remarks seemed to be to damn the whole idea of European cooperation." So you have even then the sort of dichotomy between British government supporting the creation of NATO, hostile to European cooperation. But Macmillan does not suggest, although he himself was opposed to Bevin, he does not suggest that Bevin was out of tune with the popular mood. 3 years later, Macmillan was summoned by Churchill, by then Prime Minister again, and asked about his ministerial ambitions. Churchill, writes Macmillan, said, "I suppose you want the Foreign Office." "I," says Macmillan, "I said, of course." He laughed and said he supposed I felt he had rather let down the European movement, but it was inevitable. We had got in too late and things had hardened. Now, the issues which Macmillan and other British politicians and officials wrestled with in the 1950s and 1960s have been wrestled with by British politicians in every decade since. They are embodied in the objection that comes top of the list in every opinion survey or focus group about the new European constitutional treaty, loss of sovereignty. We care about it more than do any of our other partners. It is what lay behind the famous warning given by the then Labour leader Hugh Gaitskell in the 1960s that we risked, by joining the European community, putting an end to 1,000 years of history. It is what has lain behind the enormous reluctance of every single British government since Britain joined the European community in 1973 to see any changes in the treaties to which we then signed up. Now, the validation of our national identity by our experience in World War II, of course, differentiates us from many of our continental partners, as does geography. Even with the Channel Tunnel, there is a huge psychological difference between crossing a land frontier, especially one where there are no frontier controls, and diving down under the seabed to get from France to England. To geography, add history. We lack not just the malign experience of invasion and occupation, but the more benign shared history that comes, as one of my French friends puts it, with the proximity of Piedmont and Savoie, or the existence of French and Spanish Basques, or the fact that one of the fathers of the European Union, Robert Schuman, was born a Luxembourger, was conscripted into the German army, and ended up as a senior minister of France. So although Dean Acheson himself may not be alive and well, his famous dictum about Britain's post-imperial moithering remains true, except that, as I said at the beginning, I would argue that we have a role, we simply have not found a rationale for it or emotional acceptance of it. I do not believe that we are simply hankering after our imperial past, but Britain has undergone huge social and demographic change in the last 50 years, and that has left many clinging to the old national identity we were sure of because we do not recognize what our new identity is or how it can be defined. We are a multicultural and multi-ethnic society with all the tensions and stresses as well as the excitement and vibrancy which that entails. 70% of white people in Britain described themselves as Christian in the most recent national census, although fewer than 10% of the population go to church. I believe that our nostalgia, like that figure, is part of an effort to cling to a cultural identity that was once the common heritage of British people, even though it is no longer fully shared. Now, the reality behind all of that is that we did indeed join an integrationist project, but not one that has led or is likely to lead, in my view, to the erosion of the nation state. We do indeed have a single market for goods, though not yet for services. It happened in part because of pressure from Britain under Margaret Thatcher, and it was she who accepted that to achieve that single market did require a change in the original Treaty of Rome to allow for more votes by majority so that no one country could block progress. We have indeed extended the remit of the European Union to deal with international terrorism and crime. We tried the purely intergovernmental route and found that agreements took much longer to reach and even longer to ratify and therefore ended up not being implemented. So we actually find it more efficient to ask the European Commission to come forward with proposals and to vote on them by majority and have them policed by the European Commission and the European Court. And yes, we have developed something called a European defence identity, which might indeed conflict with NATO were it not for the fact that Britain, among others, and Britain in particular, as the principal military power in Europe alongside France, has sought to ensure that the rules of that defence cooperation are about peacekeeping, not territorial defence, and that it enables Europe to take on more of the burden of defence, for example, peacekeeping in the Balkans, without conflicting with NATO's proper role. And the paradox is that Britain has been a leader in much of this. Most of the British opponents of the European Union claim to like the principle but object to the reality. But the history of our membership points in the other direction. We dislike the principle because of the loss or sharing of sovereignty it implies, but we like the practice because we see that our interests are ultimately best served by it. I think the converse might be said of our relationship with the United States. We exaggerate rather than underplay its nature and significance. Harold Macmillan's remark about the role of the British being to play the Greek to the Americans Roman was always pretentious and patronizing, but it is more inaccurate as a statement of fact than it is as a picture of how Britain sees itself in relation to the United States. Part of our desire for a close relationship is sensible self-interest. A British Prime Minister and government have a closer relationship with their American opposite numbers than exists between the United States and any other foreign government. Like the United States, we are perhaps more given to the use of hard power than are many of our partners. We maintain serious, capable, professional armed services. But we are not immune from the same dilution of the transatlantic relationship that is affecting America and Europe as a whole. The signs were there to see even before the end of the Soviet Empire. When I was in the British Embassy in Washington in the 1980s, we sent reports back to London about what my ambassador then called the shifting of the tectonic plates as the United States started to look economically and politically to Asia and the Far East, and as the Reagan administration sought to develop a policy towards its neighbors in Latin America. The process has been accelerated since the fall of the Berlin Wall in ways we all know. But even in the period when the glue holding us together was much firmer than it is now, self-interest, of course, played a larger part in it than sentiment or cultural identity. Europe was the front line of America's defense, whether it wanted it or not. The military calculation in the Cold War period was that a Soviet conventional attack would overwhelm the West's conventional forces within 48 hours unless we deployed battlefield nuclear weapons. And we knew that if the deployment of those weapons triggered a strategic nuclear response, then that would not be confined to Europe. In other words, a Soviet incursion into Western Europe could have led to a Soviet strategic nuclear attack on the United States within a matter of days. Nor were these simply theoretical calculations or theoretical fears. The Soviet threat to Berlin, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Russia's suppression of Hungary in 1956, and Czechoslovakia in 1968 all served to make us live in a world where the fear of nuclear annihilation was greater, I believe, than the fear we now have of terrorist attack. I remember when I was at school as a young teenager proposing the debating motion, "This House considers nuclear war inevitable." One of my teachers, a Benedictine monk, told me I would be proved wrong, not because the danger was not as great as I was arguing in that debate, but because as Christians we had to believe in the perfectibility of man. So far he's been proved right and I wrong, but I'm not convinced that the perfectibility of humankind has got much to do with it. But the fact that there in the early 1960s, in a school debating society, we were debating the proposition "This House considers nuclear war inevitable" shows that that for us then was the reality. In addition to that powerful glue binding Europe and America together, there were special aspects of the Anglo-American relationship, most notably the intelligence and nuclear relationship. But even Jack Kennedy, when he unleashed a huge political crisis in Britain by cancelling the Skybolt nuclear missile project, could not understand why on earth Britain should want its own so-called independent nuclear deterrent. 40 years later, some of us would agree with him, though no British government would dare change the policy, less, in my view, for good security reasons than because having your own nuclear weapons is a symbol that you are a power in the world. If the French got rid of theirs, might we follow suit? Perhaps, but neither country would be the first to move. But in defence reality, we are less dependent on the United States' willingness to share its technology and weapons systems with us than we once were. As for intelligence, the United States undoubtedly values our capability, but both of us have a greater interest in sharing intelligence product where it relates to international security than ever before, so the exclusivity of the relationship is less than it once was. I would also argue that the United States has always had a harder-headed approach to the special relationship than Britain has had. Eisenhower's treatment of Britain in the aftermath of Suez was brutal and ruthless. Kennedy cancelled Blue Streak without a backward glance, though he did save the political bacon of his good friend Macmillan by offering him an alternative, thereby contributing to General de Gaulle's first veto of Britain's application to join the common market. President Reagan's response to the Argentine invasion of the Falklands was not immediately to come to the aid of his closest ally, rather the contrary. There were interests at stake for the United States elsewhere, in particular in Latin America, which weighed heavily in the balance. And what tilted the balance was not sentiment in the administration, but pressure from congressional and public opinion. President Reagan did not hesitate to launch the invasion of Grenada, despite the fierce opposition at the time of his good friend Margaret Thatcher. So the United States has been generous and wholehearted in its commitment to the security of Europe, but it so happened that the existence of a hostile and threatening Soviet Union gave good reasons of American self-interest for that generosity and gave the whole of free Europe a reinforced sense of standing for common values and common interests. Today we still have shared values, but how far do we have common interests? In our relationship with the United States, we British claim that there is no conflict of interest between being a good European and being a good ally of the United States, by which we mean, I believe, not that there is no conflict, but that we wish there was no conflict. For some of the tensions which were first identified, or rather cogently identified at least, by John Newhouse in De Gaulle and the Anglo-Saxons, have not gone away. But now Britain finds itself torn more than in the past between the United States, whose closest friend it wants to be, and its European partners with whom its interests most closely align. And here I mean political and not just trade interests. There is a British view of the Middle East, of Iran, of China, of the poverty agenda, of climate change, which we share more closely with France than we do with the United States, though we would never say it. Even on defence, while we may suspect ultimate French goals and motives, we, the British, did a deal with France and Germany on a stronger European defence capability, not just because we could not otherwise have influenced them, but because we shared much of their analysis. And we are left with the impression that United States objections at the time to those arrangements were not rooted in substantive objection so much as an unease at Europe embarking on activity over which the United States would have little control. In other words, there would be peacekeeping operations in which the United States would not want to participate, but which she would nonetheless wish to be able to veto. Now, Iraq, self-evidently, brought all of that uncomfortably to a head. All of the European governments which opposed the war had the overwhelming support of their electorates. All of the European governments which supported the war faced the opposition of their electorates. It was more nuanced in Britain than in, say, Spain or Italy, but it is a long time since a million people across the political spectrum took to the streets of London as they did in protest before the Iraq war. And if the British people had known then what we all now know about the lack of WMD in Iraq and the dubious legal basis for the war, I believe that support would have dissipated. And Britain's role as a bridge, a transatlantic bridge, is a largely self-appointed one, and I believe in practice we operate less as a bridge than as a bastion. And if we are to be a bridge, we must learn not to carry the traffic in one direction only. I am sure Prime Minister Blair has used his influence to effect with President Bush over American engagement in the Middle East peace process, for example. But we rarely seek, as Britain, to convey a European view and to portray it as our own and to try and orchestrate concerted European pressure where our views and those of our partners coincide. Tony Blair would argue that it is a mistake to hector, but we sometimes lend ourselves to the divide and rule policies of the American government, policies which any self-respecting American government would practice faced with what otherwise might be irresistible pressure from a united Europe. The case for a more prominent role of genuine leadership in Europe by Britain is, I believe, a strong one, because we have, I think, on the one hand, a rather less favourable set of circumstances in Europe than we did once have. In the period of the 70s and 80s, there was, under Giscard d'Estaing of France and Schmidt of Germany, and then under Kohl and Mitterrand, there was clear Franco-German leadership of the European community and then the European Union. It often went in directions which were unpalatable to British governments, but it was going with the grain of opinion in the European community. And it was that combination of a powerful commission led by Jacques Delors, supported by Kohl and Mitterrand, that enabled dynamic progress in the European Union to be made. I believe today that France and Germany do not provide the same kind of leadership. And indeed, I personally, as a pro-European, regret it that some of the language that comes out of France and Germany is now saying to the new countries of the European Union, if they maintain their competitive tax rates, then on the one hand, they cannot expect to have structural and cohesion fund money from France and Germany on the other, because I think if we go down that route, we damage the essential generosity of the wealthier towards the less wealthy members of the European Union that has always been one of its hallmarks and one of its one of the keys to its success. And one of our problems is that because we in Britain have our own particular, rather intergovernmentalist view of the European Union, we are not actually capable of filling a vacuum of leadership within the European Union to the extent that I believe is desirable. I believe that the so-called bicycle theory of Europe is broadly correct. In other words, that unless you maintain momentum, then you risk the project falling into disrepair. That in the absence of integration, we will be faced not with consolidation, but with disintegration. The British government's view that basically the large member states should find a way of managing the European Union and that the supranational institutions are secondary to that purpose is, in my view, deeply flawed. The secret of the Union's success is that it does have institutions that have managed the querulous relationship between countries that remain fiercely nationalistic, that those same institutions are capable of harnessing the shared value systems and economic interests of the member states and creating value added for the membership of the Union as a whole. And that momentum needs to be maintained. I would argue that it can be maintained without the pace being unnegotiable and without the belief that the end product has to be some kind of federal structure which undermines the continued existence of the nation state. This is not the triumph of the British view over anybody else's view. Instead, it requires Britain to understand the importance of the supranational parts of the European Union and to strengthen them. It requires some of our partners to understand that the old vision of the EU of six has been replaced by one in which Europe's stability and security is assured by its expansion to help create and include other democratic states. And I use the word create deliberately because there was nothing inevitable about the course which has been taken by the countries of Eastern and Central Europe or the course that is now being taken by Turkey. The existence of a powerful European Union which acts as a pole of attraction economically and which sets some very tough political criteria for membership has played a hugely influential part. The people of Slovakia might well have re-elected the dictator Mečiar to the presidency of their country 2 years ago had it not been for the warnings of the European Union that a Slovakia led by Mečiar could not be admitted to EU membership. And the EU is right to say to the government of Croatia now that you cannot both pretend to membership of the European Union and be incapable of coming to terms with the need to bring to justice a man suspected of terrible war crimes. So we have on our hands, on the one hand, a European success story, a Europe of 25 democracies bound by a common set of rules, locked into a framework which makes it unlikely that any one of them could be tilted in a rogue direction. And that same European Union is still acting as a magnet to others. On the other hand, we have the internal tensions I have described. France and Germany, the traditional motors of development in Europe, are no longer that driving force. And Britain, which should see the importance of strong supranational institutions for the success of Europe, is so bedeviled by its own internal debate about whether we should be in or out of the project at all that we cannot contribute and thereby contribute to the essential cohesion of the European Union, which is essential for its success. Despite all that, I remain warily optimistic. The overall commitment of countries to the enterprise remains strong. If the Constitutional Treaty is ratified and comes into force, then it contains within it the means to help make the European Union a more effective player on the international stage. But the institutional mechanisms of the European Union only work if the large member states are prepared to let them work. And we have seen how enfeebled those mechanisms can become, even when the supranational structures of the EU are tilted in their favour. In foreign policy, the structures will remain essentially intergovernmental for the foreseeable future and subject to unanimous agreement. So the ability of the EU to project a powerful foreign policy will only be as strong as the coherence of the member states, and that coherence is growing, but still inadequate. We see its inadequacy over Russia, where we are too ready to run after Putin, and where there is a lack of concerted use of the levers at the EU's disposal. We see it more effectively deployed, albeit mistakenly in my view, over the issue of arms sales to China. And we see it over Iran and the Middle East peace process, where a genuine partnership between Europe and the United States is essential to success, and where Europe does at least have a coherent view. the evolution of a foreign and security policy will pose problems for the ability of the United States to dictate a clear path and be confident of European support. The relative absence of hard power in Europe will not make it easier for outsiders to mould the application of soft power. Soft power is nonetheless power, and the European Union will deploy it, looking for agreement with the United States, but not being prepared to subordinate its own interests. These issues will not be swiftly or easily resolved. But just as the Europe-United States relationship is changing, so is the UK-United States relationship. Britain has, I believe, a part to play in working out the EU-US relationship, but we will have more influence as Europeans working with our partners than as Britain standing Horatio-like on the famous bridge. In a stand-up row, one of many, Churchill said to De Gaulle, if Britain is forced to choose between Europe and the Atlantic, le grand large, it will always choose the Atlantic. Tony Blair would try hard to avoid saying the same. He will, as any British Prime Minister, try to avoid having to make a choice. Over Iraq, he did make a choice, one he stands by, but which has not been without cost. He would find it harder to make that choice now because he would have much less leeway domestically. Iraq is a particularly stark example, and the day-to-day reality is that with our EU partners, Britain is making choices the whole time, and many of those choices put us at odds with the United States. On climate change, Iran, China, the poverty agenda, we are managing differences, not always reconciling them. On trade issues, we, Britain, are combining with our partners to do more than manage our differences. We pitch our economic weight against that of the United States. The WTO may manage our quarrels, but they are real quarrels nonetheless. In Britain, people are more aware than they were of growing transatlantic divergence, not least because the substance and style of the Bush administration are so different from those they are familiar with. British public views of the Bush administration do not differ much from the European norm. The big question for the next few months for us in Britain will be how far that translates into a greater sense of Europeanness. So far, the answer is not very far. I was on a platform, in a public platform a few months ago with a well-known British Eurosceptic journalist who would, I thought, express himself as opposed to British ratification of the EU constitution. His thesis was the following. The economic argument for the EU is no longer valid, he said. The constitution is worthless, but the world is a dangerous place. We can no longer trust the United States. Our fellow Europeans are the only friends we have got, so we had better vote for Europe. I agree with his conclusion, if not with the rationale which underlines it. The EU is, I believe, the most important and precious political development of my lifetime. Britain, France, and Germany had a brief experiment with trilateralism, the three of them trying to run the, or give direction to the European Union. But it was primarily about intergovernmental leadership, and it was doomed to failure. Unless Tony Blair and President Chirac and Chancellor Schroeder and the other governments of Europe can rediscover and champion the supranational vision of the EU, we will not carry conviction with our publics or maintain our coherence and momentum. And we will be a querulous partner of the United States, not an effective one. So the stakes are very high indeed, and the next few months will be decisive ones. Thank you.
This is a very fine paper indeed, and I have very few disagreements with it. Referendums are very dangerous things. It's like playing Russian roulette. Because people can vote yes or no for reasons that have extremely little to do with the subject at hand. De Gaulle discovered this when he lost the last one in 1969, and Mitterrand almost discovered it when he almost lost the referendum on the Maastricht Treaty, at which he was saved by a few fractions of a point, with many people voting no, not because they had read Maastricht, which was indeed unreadable, but because they didn't like this or that aspect of policy, or because they didn't like him, and that was lots of people by that time. So it's very dangerous, and I confess that it's very noble to go to the people and ask for a vote, yes or no. On the other hand, it depends on how much you want to risk. When you have a safe majority in your parliament, where you could get the treaty, since it's the treaty of the constitutional treaty we're talking about, ratified quite easily, is it wise to take risks? Because, after all, people may even vote no, because in England it may have to do with sympathy or antipathy for Blair and so on. I admire the risk takers, but they frighten me a little bit, insofar as they didn't have to take those risks. But that's a comment. On paper, trusting the people is fine. In practice, when one has a safe parliament, why not rely on it? Isn't that the whole idea of representative government? But that's the musings of a political scientist who is more concerned with the results than he is with the method. What the paper says about Britain, it's on page 4, and you've heard it, having a sort of nostalgia of clinging to a cultural identity that was once the common heritage of British people, even though it is no longer fully shared, is something that could be said in exactly the same terms about France. I think also the paper is to be commended for a remarkably candid critique on another page of United Kingdom policies, the bridge role as a bridge being a largely self-appointed one, and of the British being much more enamored of this special relationship with Great Britain than anybody in Washington really is. The one point, not surprisingly, or a set of points on which I disagree is in your analysis of French policy. I'm French. So, needless to say, I have my doubts about what you say on France, because I don't think it's accurate. This comes in your page 9, which you toned down when you read it. I don't think that the French government rejects the Commission's, European Commission's modest proposals for a single market in services because they fear the competition from within the enlarged Union. They criticize it because the French have developed an extraordinary attachment to their public services, which are state services. Since I have been living for the last 50 years in the United States, I have become much more appreciative of French public services. They work. It costs a hell of a lot, and they are indeed not competitive. It's very difficult to find competitive trains these days. On the other hand, I must say, I envy the French for their trains. You can, after all, now circulate from go from Paris to Marseille in 3 hours. The French side of the Channel train is more efficient than the British one. If I'm not mistaken, the British have asked French engineers to come to the rescue, which is a tribute of a rather remarkable tribute. And I do think that it is an attachment which one may regret, this attachment to a public form of services. But it's both very widely shared in France, and it is anybody who would like to change this too quickly would run, to put it mildly, into violent troubles, I mean very strong troubles with the unions. The socialists would not want to risk that if they were still in power, and this government does not want to risk that. I think this is much more important than the reason you mentioned. The reason why so many people in France seem to be hostile to Turkish entry, I think, is not because they feel that it was weakened further what used to be the Franco-German leadership. I think most of them know perfectly well that the days of Franco-German rule in Europe are gone. It's a very complex mix of feelings. In some cases, and I have many French friends who are very strongly opposed to the entry of Turkey, it is a kind of a strange, I mean, I mention this particularly because you are a Catholic. It is a very strong Catholic streak in France, which is, for reasons which I don't share at all, opposed to the entry of Turkey. The sense Europe is deeply Christian, the Turks are not Christian, and if I may be blunt, it's bad enough to have millions of them on our soil. We can't do anything about it. They are there, and we need them. They're doing all kind of work which our people don't like to do. But it is fundamentally not a part of Europe. It is expressed in an almost blissfully irrational way by that supreme rationalist who is Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. And I think he reflects something which I see among many French friends who are usually rational, except when it comes to the subject of Turkey. It's very interesting. I think it's perhaps because people who are not young, some of them are younger than I am, but that's very easy, but they are not young, are used to this map of Europe where Europe stops at the border of between Poland and Russia and stops at Turkey. I cannot psychoanalyze my compatriots very easily on this, but it is a feeling which I think has very little to do with Franco-German leadership of Europe, which I think most people know is gone. And I'll come back to that in a minute. I would like to push you a little farther on a number of points with which I entirely agree. One has to do with this whole problem of the relation between the EU and the United States. I think that many people in France and in Germany and in Italy have serious doubts about the compatibility which Mr. Blair assumes rather than demonstrates between American foreign policy and the interests of the EU. And this, I think, is due to the tone and the style and, indeed, the whole ideology behind the Bush administration in the last years. There are, it seems to me, and I don't want to magnify it, but it is the job of an academic, I think, to sharpen things from time to time, between a vision which is behind this administration's foreign policy, which is profoundly, it's not just unipolar, it is profoundly imperial, hegemonic, and a vision which the EU is inevitably embodying of a world in which there are other centers of power than the United States. That doesn't mean that one goes back to the European balance of power of the 19th century, but it is a vision in which the EU is to have some genuine autonomy. And I think that the behavior of the British government in the last couple of years has made a number of people on the continent doubt whether this approach is compatible with the notion of a EU which can, with whatever power it has, play a relatively autonomous role. I think that there are many people, I'm not talking about the French government, but there are many people in France who would like, I wouldn't say a triumvirate, but who would like to have Britain, France, and Germany provide a certain impulse, precisely because the institutions, even after the treaty of the constitutional treaty is ratified, will not be very strong institutions, and at least until they have been reinforced in the next treaty. So this is to me very much a transitional constitution. There will have to be some states providing the impulse which will make those supranational institutions a function. If it cannot be just Germany and France anymore, and it cannot be simply France, Germany, and let us say Poland as a representative of the East European countries, it has to be these countries plus Great Britain. But does Great Britain, in its attempt at trying to combine what the French would call la chèvre et le chou, can they bring it off? Can you still behave on the one hand as the best and most loyal ally of the United States and as the champion of a European idea which does require a certain political autonomy? I would also, since I do believe that sooner or later, and sooner rather than later, there will be a need to reinforce these institutions. The Constitution is a compromise which is remarkably non-Cartesian in many respects. What are your views about where it does need to be reinforced, where it does need to be made a little bit less shaky than it is? Last point I want to make is I think you have a splendid list of topics on which indeed the EU could play a very important role. You mentioned the importance of the environment. There is one which I think is an area in which the EU could make a very important contribution, and which we see every day that it is being neglected. And that's what I would call not nation building. You can't build a nation. Nations make themselves. It's state building. Frankly, I don't see much interest in state building in this country. When you talk to the military, they will tell you proudly that they don't do state building. Others may want to do it, but we don't do this. And I was teaching a course with a close friend. We were asked at the end of the course by the students if there's anything on which I, who am an agnostic, and he, who is a Catholic priest, disagree. And I said, nothing, only the existence of God. But we had military students in our class, and they made it very clear that they're not interested in state building. The American army is there to kill enemies. I said, yes, but look, Europeans, armies, the Scandinavians, the British, the Indians, etc., have no such objection to state building. General Dallaire, unfortunate hero and victim of the UN forces in Rwanda, said that he was very proud when he was in Rwanda of having soldiers accompany students to school, which is something which Condi Rice unforgettably said was not a decent mission for the American army. The answer we got from one of the American army said, yes, maybe they do that, but we, sir, are the American army. That's not much of an answer. And I think that we will find again and again that in a world in which half of the states at least are collapsing states, weak states, disintegrated states or disintegrating states, or murderous states, state building is going to be a very important mission. That precisely because of its membership, the EU countries have a certain experience in it. It requires a lot of money. But I'd rather spend it for this than for military budgets, frankly. I don't know what the U.S. can do with $425 billion for defense. These are all important issues, and I thank you for a really lovely paper and a very beautifully written one. But I will never cease to admire the capacity of British civil servants, even when they have not yet joined the Catholic Church, to write beautiful prose. I wish Americans did the same.
You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University. Tonight's lecture was titled, Where is Britain? The UK, the EU, and the United States. It was given by Sir Stephen Wall, permanent representative to the European Union and former EU advisor to Tony Blair. Responding was Stanley Hoffman, Paul and Catherine Buttenweiser University professor at Harvard University. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.